behalf of Justices Baker and Triana, I'd like to welcome you to the Third Court of Appeals. We only have one case set for oral argument this afternoon, so I'm going to go with the instructions and then I'll call the case. As you know, you each have 20 minutes to make your argument. I'm assuming that you have divided up your time. Is that, and you instructed the clerk about that?
We've got 15 on the clock right now.
Great, thank you. On the lighting system, when you see yellow, that means you have 2 minutes left in your argument. When you see red, that means you're out of time. If you could please finish responding to whatever question we have asked. We ask a lot of questions. So when you're finished responding to that question, go ahead and wrap up. Otherwise, look to the court if you needed to and are hoping to say something else. Today's proceedings are being audio recorded. The recording will be available on the court's website within a day or two. I heard this morning they said that they should be up there this afternoon. That's pretty fast, so we'll see. And housekeeping. For those of you in the audience, if you have any cell phones or other devices that would cause noise, please turn them off or on silent so that they don't make noise and distract from the attorney's arguments. And with that, we're going to turn to our case, which is cause number 18457CV, Thomas A. Dyke versus David Reed Hall individually and in his capacity as trustee for the David Reed Hall Trust number one. And announcements.
Your Honor, Kevin Terrazas, on behalf of the appellant, I have the appellant, Mr. Thomas Dyke, with me today.
Thank you.
And Todd Smith, here on behalf of the appellee, Mr. Hall, and the trust.
Very good. Whenever you're ready, sir.
May it please the court. As the Texas Supreme Court and this court have repeatedly held, the TCPA is to be applied broadly to numerous causes of action and many different types of circumstances. In this case, Appellee Hall's new claims, just as new ones that we're looking at today, are based on, related to, and in response to statements that Mr. Dyke made in judicial filings that are related to services in the marketplace, as well as alleged attorney-client relationships. Those are exercises of Mr. Dyke's right to petition and right of free speech on a matter of public concern. Therefore, the TCPA applies. Once the court finds that the TCPA applies, the burden, of course, shifts to the appellee here, Mr. Hall, to provide clear and specific evidence. But rather than do so, in the district court, he made a number of conclusory statements, failed to link any element to any piece of evidence, and asserted simply that he met his burden. As the Cavan v. Abbott case from this court shows, that's not permissible. You can't just wave your hands over a large number of documents and say, we've satisfied the standard. The TCPA applies, and Mr. Hall failed to meet his burden. Therefore, the district court erred, and Mr. Dyke respectfully requests that this court dismiss the new claims in the petition and remand for further proceedings. In terms of the TCPA and the right to petition, the new claims are based on the filings that Mr. Dyke made in the district court, his counterclaims as well as his summary judgment. The new claims in the petition specifically cite and block quote those judicial filings in those documents, the motion for summary judgment and the petition. That is invoking and talking about, related to, based on Mr. Dyke's statements and judicial filings, which are clearly statements related to the right to petition. As former Justice Pemberton wrote in his concurrence in Seraphine, if he had rolled over and talked to his wife in bed and said, I've got another oral argument I'm hearing today on a TCPA matter, that would invoke the right to petition. And I understand that's very broad, but that's what the legislature has written, and that's the way the Texas Supreme Court has interpreted.
Is that a claim predicated on that constitutionally protected right?
Your Honor, in terms of his speech, if the claim, as it does here, cites to those and claims that they are judicial admissions, that they are using in support of their claims as evidence, yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And similar to like the Hawkshurst case, when we're talking about a motion for sanctions. It is the motion for sanctions and the fact that it was seeking attorney's fees is what made it fall under the TCPA ambit, regardless of what the underlying proceeding in terms of the motion for sanctions was about. It was, sorry, Your Honor, did you have a question?
No, I'm thinking that through.
Yeah, but Your Honor, so it's, I'm not saying that that his simple statement like that would ever be brought up, I'm sorry, when I miss his, Justice Pemberton's, would ever be brought up as a claim. But that's the breadth of it, as the Texas Supreme Court has said in the Coleman case and others, is that it simply has to be tangentially related in a way and for it. And it's talking about the right of free speech on a matter of public concern, but it would apply as well to the right to petition, because the Texas Supreme Court has interpreted the TCPA to be so broad that anything that is related to, like here, the specific statements that Mr. Dyke made in judicial filings, which were the basis, it's clearly the basis in the for the new claims in the petition, that's what they cite to as their evidence.
Can I ask you a question? And I'm sorry, I don't remember. did the district court find that the TCPA did not apply, or did the district court find that it applied but that the plaintiff had met?
The second, Your Honor, the latter, that the district court found that the TCPA did apply. It was at least partially based on those statements, which were judicial filings, or excuse me, in judicial filings, but that the appellee here had met the burden for clear and specific evidence.
Okay.
Your Honor, in terms of the factual predicated conduct as well, because that was something that appellee raised, when we're looking at that, this court has on several occasions dismissed claims, even when the claims themselves may not have been factually predicated, because they were related to the conduct that was at issue under the TCPA. The Cavan v. Abbott case, the Grant v. Pivot case are two clear examples where they dismiss conversion claims. In Cavan, they also dismissed an intrusion upon seclusion claim and an abuse of process claim. In Grant, it was in addition to the conversion claim, there was theft. There was a harmful access by computer claim that was dismissed. Again, they were all because they were based on that predicated conduct of what was going on in those, the right of free speech, as well as in the Cavan case, the right of right to petition. In terms of the right of free speech, what's being alleged, and again, we're not saying that we agree with any of the allegations in Mr. Hall's petition, but under the Hirsch v. Tatum case from the Texas Supreme Court, it says we have to simply go by what they have pled, not what the actual facts may be, even if there is a denial. And what they pled are, in terms of the right of free speech, is the relationship between attorneys and clients, compliance with disciplinary rules, fee agreements, services that are allegedly rendered. All of those are related to, are they're based on, related to, response to matters of public concern. So therefore, the right of free speech also would apply. Now, there was raised in Pelley's brief the question of, well, does this apply to declaratory judgment claims? Mm-hmm. And numerous courts have applied the TCPA to declaratory judgment claims. Most of those don't analyze it very much, but I would say that this court in the Hawkshurst case provides the example of why it would apply, because it's not just a standalone declaratory judgment claim that's being made. There are declaratory judgment claims that are being made with a request for attorney's fees. Those attorney's fees are legal relief. Therefore, it would apply just like it would apply in the Hawkshurst case to a motion for sanctions or any other claim or pleading that is being made that is asking for legal relief like attorney's fees.
So Hawkshurst is more controlling rather than Craig.
I actually think Craig is as well, Your Honor.
Uh-huh.
Because in Craig.
But I was going to go a little bit beyond that. What is Craig's? How much should we be looking to Craig in light of Harper, or does Harper have any from the Supreme Court?
Right, Your Honor. What I'd say with Craig is, and I've got a quote that I think from Craig, it's on page 302 of that opinion that I think is the one that's important here, is it says, it is not promotions declaratory claims that present a potential justiciability problem in this case, but rather the posture of appellant's TCPA motion attacking those claims. I think that Craig took an analysis of this and said that it would apply to declaratory judgment claims, even with Harper. But, Your Honor, that there the problem was is that if you—
The waiver issue.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. If you allege all the conduct before, that the declaratory judgment claims are just kind of me too. Just like with declaratory judgment claims, you can't get attorney's fees if they're simply saying, you declare you breached this contract and you've got a breach of contract claim before. It's, they're almost a nullity. And so I think what my understanding is that the court was saying, look, it's not the problem that they're declaratory judgment claims. The problem is the posture here, that these declaratory judgment claims are almost irrelevant to all this. And so if we put TCPA and dismiss those claims, what are we saying about the other claims that have bad results? Your Honor, talking about waiver with what you were just saying, one of the issues here, and we raised it a few times in our brief, is that appellee on appeal raised a number of issues that were never raised before. The question of whether or not the Declaratory Judgment Act, the TCPA could apply to that, wasn't raised below. That the claims are factually predicated on something else than what the statements were, wasn't raised below. That all the declaratory judgment for clear and specific evidence that needs to be shown is that there's a controversy that can be resolved, wasn't raised below. That there's exceptions to the breach of fiduciary duty in terms of what they have to prove on this. Again, all those weren't raised below. But even what they did raise, when you look at either both a district court or now in terms of clear and specific evidence, they don't meet their standard. Talking about in terms of even if they hadn't waived this point about whether or not the Declaratory Judgment Act, all you have to show is that there's a controversy and that it can be resolved. This took me a while to think about, because I've seen some of the courts of opinions that will use just that standard. There's others that there's at least one that has gone through the declaratory judgment and had them prove what the ultimate merits were. But the statute requires a prima facie case as to each element, each essential element of the claim at issue. Lipsky described the prima facie case as meaning evidence sufficient as a matter of law to establish a given fact if it is not rebutted or contradicted. And it says in another way, it is the minimum quantum of evidence necessary to support a rational inference that the allegation of fact is true. So that's to establish a prima facie case, but then the question is you have to establish a prima facie case as to an element. And Black's Law Dictionary defines an element as a constituent part of a claim that must be proved for the claim to succeed. And so just by the idea that you need to just show there's a controversy and it can be resolved, the problem with that is for jurisdictional purposes. Is this going to be an advisory opinion at all? To actually show that the claim is going to succeed, you have to show that you would be successful on that, what you're requesting in terms of declaratory judgment. And that's what they needed to show. That's what Mr. Hall needed to show in the district court. Didn't do that. Didn't argue below that all you need to show is a controversy, and never provided any evidence even showing controversy or that the declaration would resolve that controversy. Instead, what he said is basically there's an attorney-client relationship and therefore we win. And that's a lot of what they did on appeal as well. On page 45 of their response brief, he says, the face of Hall's live petition and TCPA response, along with the incorporated pleadings and evidence, are more than sufficient to show the existence of a justiciable controversy between Dyke and Hall, thus satisfying the first element of a UDGA claim. It's those kinds of statements that were made throughout, as opposed to going into each declaration and actually showing those were the claims that were sought. Here's the evidence to show, even if there was a controversy that could be resolved, or the underlying what you'd actually have to show to succeed on those claims. In terms of breach of fiduciary duty, another point in terms of, again, I don't think that they've raised these issues below about there being a presumption, but on appeal they've suggested that there's a presumption effectively if you can say that there's an attorney-client relationship, that you automatically get to bypass the motion to dismiss stage because there's a presumption that it's unfair, any sort of agreement you get into. And as long as you plead for fee forfeiture, no matter showing that fee forfeiture is deserved or even the amount of fee forfeiture, which it doesn't do here, that you win, you bypass it. And I tried to research a little bit on like 12b-6 because seeing this would come up in the federal context, I will not represent that I have done an exhaustive search on this, but I haven't found it to come up. And that would be odd to have a situation where you could just say there's a presumption and therefore if I bring a breach of fiduciary duty claim related to an attorney, not involving even an attorney-client relationship involving a case, but just something separate, that you automatically bypass any sort of motion to dismiss. That just doesn't make sense. And I don't think that that is what the statute says, even in, for example, for the fee forfeiture issue, one of the cases that was cited often is the Gammon case, and cited often, I say, by Apelli. And even in the Gammon case at page 3 of the Westlaw site, it says, once any necessary factual disputes relevant to the issue have been resolved by the trier of fact, the trial court must determine whether the attorney's conduct was a clear and serious breach of duty to his client, whether any of the attorney's compensation should be forfeited, and if so, the amount of forfeiture. So even on the fee forfeiture issue, even under Gammon, it says you still have to show a breach of fiduciary duty. You still have to show that compensation should be forfeited, and you have to show the amount of forfeiture. And for example, here is another, is that there was no damages asserted. There was no clear and specific evidence even as to the amount of fees. It was similar to, and I'm about to run out of time, Your Honor, if I may just finish this. It's similar to in Lipsky, where affiant alleged that there was all this harm and that it was in excess of $3 million. Here, the best they have is to say in their pleading that it's in excess of $160,000. And that's it. That's their total evidence. And Your Honor, I'm out of time, so I don't want to do more. Thank you.
May it please the court. There are a couple of sort of threshold issues that I'd like to bring to the court's attention in my argument today. One is we've got an argument here that we just didn't supply sufficient evidence to support, to the extent that we had a burden, that Mr. Hall had a burden in this case. And it's not delved into in great detail in the briefs, but the point and the suggestion has been made that Mr. Hall could not rely on incorporating his summary judgment motion and the exhibits attached to that motion in the context of his TCPA response. I think, and admittedly, if the court looks at our TCPA response, it does say a number of times, you know, we have filed the motion for summary judgment. Please see motion for summary judgment incorporated by reference here too, along with the attached exhibits. So in ordinary pleading practice in Texas, you know, the rules specifically allow incorporation by reference. And so that would be enough for us to be able to rely on not only those pleadings, which of course the burden of proof in the context of a TCPA response allows reliance on pleadings as evidence in an exception to the rule that usually holds that pleadings aren't evidence. We'd be able to rely on those pleadings and also the evidence that's attached. And so Mr. Dyke would like for the court to strictly construe the provision in the TCPA that says you get to rely on pleadings, and I think it says attached exhibits or something like that.
Petition and the attachments?
Something like that, yes, okay. Justice Goodwin. But the statute is not required to be read that narrowly. I mean, pleadings are pleadings. You know, we cited these other materials, and what it's 27.006A, Justice
Thank
Goodwin,
you.
That provides that the trial court shall consider the pleadings in supporting and opposing affidavits,
Has any court done that, do you know?
Not that I'm aware of, and in fact, I believe there's one or two recent decisions in which the courts have actually looked to other pleadings and not just the TCPA response.
Okay.
And to help or to analyze whether in our position, the appellee met the burden of proving by clear and specific evidence the elements of their claim.
Okay.
I don't think any other court has said that, and I think that's evident by the fact that there's no authority cited in Mr. Dyke's brief for the idea that we can't rely on our summary judgment materials when
okay.
we're trying to establish, to the extent we bore a burden under the TCPA, that we did meet that burden. I direct the court's attention to the Fawcett case that's cited in our brief. It is instructive. If there were, we've heard a lot of talk about waiver this afternoon, but if there were going to be a point of waiver, I would urge the court to take a look at that case, which says if you're going to complain about somebody's pleadings being insufficient, not being able to go back and refer to other pleadings in Fawcett case, particularly ones that were superseded by amendment, and the exhibits therefore were also superseded, then you need to specially accept and bring that to the opposing party's attention, or else you waive that complaint. So the short answer,
well, what we usually do in TCPA is we look at the pleading originally filed, not all the subsequent amendments to it, for the purposes of determining the TCPA motion.
I don't think that's incorrect at all, Your Honor. The only thing I'm suggesting is Mr. Dyke is suggesting Mr. Hall didn't cite evidence, and
okay.
it's repeated
okay.
in the brief that we didn't, in our TCPA motion, didn't say this, that, or the other, and didn't provide evidence of this, that, or the other. And what I'm arguing to the court is you can't or shouldn't just look at the TCPA response. We incorporated by reference our motion for summary judgment that addresses specifically the elements, the newly pleaded declaratory judgment claims.
And so, Mr. Smith, assuming we think that the TCPA applies, can you cite us specifically where, I guess you're telling me it's in the motion for summary judgment, the evidence that in the record that supports your prima facie case?
I think it would be some parts of it are attached to the response, Justice Triana. Mr. Hall filed a declaration. I'm trying to think what else. The portions of the record, if the court will look at the second supplemental clerk's record, and there's some confusion about what the supplemental clerk's records are in this case that I can clear up for the court in a post-submission letter. We had some issues with numbering. I don't want to take up the court's time going over, but this is certainly the second supplemental clerk's record at pages 56 to 59 are where those particular arguments are made and references are made to the summary judgment evidence.
Okay.
In terms of the prima facie case. Now there is a threshold factual issue on top of this sort of threshold procedural issue, and that is there or is there not an attorney-client relationship between Mr. Dyke and Mr. Hall? If there is, then it does change the burdens of proof if we're going to be held to having to bring forward clear and specific evidence to support a prima facie case on a declaratory judgment claim, which I'm frankly still kind of confused about what that is. You're asking to construe a legal instrument. In the act specifically authorizes a suit to do that. So we have here clearly the management agreement, which is a legal instrument that the lawsuit originally asked and continues to ask in the amended form for the court to construe the party's rights and obligations under that agreement. There's no dispute that these are the two parties to the agreement. And whether, you know, what those rights and obligations are going to be determinative of the lawsuit, at least the declaratory judgment claim. But back to the point about attorney-client relationship, one point that's made, I think several times in the appellant's briefing is that, well, there certainly was no attorney-client relationship in the context of the management agreement. But that's not what we're arguing. Oh, well, I take it back. We are arguing that as one basis. There is an argument in our petition that this is a fee agreement. Okay, they deny that, and that's fine. But what we argue in an even sort of more fundamental or basic context is that there is a pre-existing attorney-client relationship between Mr. Dyke and Mr. Hall. And there is absolutely clear and specific evidence in this record to support that. And if there is such an attorney-client relationship, then it establishes the actual duty as a fiduciary as a matter of law. And so, and yes, that does, as has been pointed out already to the court, shift the burden of proving fairness of the transaction to Mr. Dyke.
So let me ask a couple of questions. So is your breach of fiduciary duty claim only depend on whether he's an attorney or not, or do y'all have other breaches of fiduciary duty? Or is there another fiduciary relationship?
There is not, to my knowledge, we have not alleged another fiduciary relationship.
Okay.
It does turn, and again, it's two phases, Justice Triana. It's the fiduciary duty existing as of the date, prior to the date mm-hmm. that the management agreement was entered into. That's November 25th, because this date is incorrect in some of the briefing, and I apologize for that. November 25th of 2015 is the operative date, the date the management agreement was entered into. We argue there is a pre-existing attorney-client relationship as of November 25th of 2015. We also argue that there's an ongoing attorney-client relationship that's in connection with and maybe even apart from the management agreement. And just to jump ahead a little bit in my argument, the clear and specific evidence of an attorney-client relationship predating the management agreement appears in the second supplemental clerk's record, page 88, and that is cited in the motion for summary judgment at CR 56. And that evidence is on October 6th of 2015, Mr. Dyke wrote an email describing himself as, quote, an attorney representing David Hall regarding a proposed lease. He's holding himself out as Mr. Hall's attorney before the existence of the management agreement.
So let's assume that we agree that there's an attorney-client relationship between Mr. Dyke and Mr. Hall. Where do we go? And I hear Mr. Terrazas's argument that you're arguing that there's a presumption. I understand you're saying the burden shifts to them to show that it's a fair agreement, but I heard him argue that you're requesting that there's a presumption of unfairness. Is that what you're arguing, that the fact that there was an attorney, if there was an attorney-client relationship, that it's presumed to be unfair and they have to show that it was fair?
The management agreement is presumed to be unfair if there's a previously existing attorney-client relationship before the execution of the management agreement. Yes, that's the law. Based on the case law cited in our brief, it is, and I believe the Gammon case that Mr. Trozis referred to does address this. That's a very comprehensive decision out of this court, and we do cite it quite a bit because it applies. If a lawyer is going to go make an agreement with his client, it has to be fair, and if there's a pre-existing attorney-client relationship, that's exactly what the fiduciary duty requires, is absolute, complete fairness. And so what happens, and what this is just an application of the law in Texas, as stated in the Gammon opinion, that if the lawyer has to come forward and demonstrate that the transaction's fair and reasonable to the client. And
okay,
what that
but
does.
That, but okay, I understand that shifting of the burden to them to show that it's fair, but where is the presumption? Are you saying that that in itself means that there's a presumption of unfairness?
The cases say that there's a presumption of unfairness. Okay. That's the language used in the case law, Justice Triana.
Okay.
There was one other piece of evidence that I wanted to point out, just to kind of loop back and close on the issue of this attorney-client, pre-existing attorney-client relationship. On November 24th of 2015, the day before the parties executed the management agreement, Mr. Dyke wrote a demand letter describing himself as Mr. Hall's, quote, attorney of record in connection with a minor car accident. This is in Supplemental Clerk's Record 128. It's cited in the motion for summary judgment at CR 56. So there again, you know, there really isn't any dispute, at least not a reasonable dispute, that there's clear and specific evidence of an attorney-client relationship. Mr. Dyke is holding himself out as Mr. Hall's attorney to third parties. That certainly satisfies our burden. And this is something that at the hearing in the trial court wasn't denied by Mr. Dyke's lawyers under a questioning from the trial court. So there is, based on this evidence, there is a fiduciary duty in this case. Now, the judicial admission at issue, because we should get on to that, is that his declaration that Mr. Terrazas referred to that was attached to Mr. Dyke's own motion for summary judgment independently establishes an attorney-client relationship. So, and the reason it does that is because in that declaration, Mr. Dyke says he did things like draft agreements, conducted legal research. He counseled Mr. Hall on document interpretation. He advised Mr. Hall on legal issues. And it's not disputed that Mr. Dyke is a licensed attorney. These are all the types of activities that are commonly known to be activities taken on by a lawyer representing a client. So this is additional clear and specific evidence of the attorney-client relationship. And yet, what has gone on in this case, to kind of get to the meat, is that Mr. Dyke is asking this court to say, doesn't matter, I can admit all I want that I'm an attorney and I'm representing Mr. Hall, and I can say it in a declaration filed with the court. But what Mr. Hall is not allowed to do in this situation is to turn around and use that declaration, which is he filed as summary judgment evidence, to prove his breach of fiduciary duty case. And I'll just get right to it in the interest of time. I've got about 5 minutes left. There is a doctrine that this court has indicated that is willing to apply in certain situations, the absurdity doctrine. It's a doctrine of statutory construction. Yes, admittedly, as Mr. Terrazas has pointed out, we all know how broad the TCPA is, and we know what the Supreme Court has said in Coleman. We know what this court has reluctantly said in a number of opinions that are really interesting reads, because you can tell how much the justices, former justices on this court, have struggled with this issue. And whether the legislature actually intended this or not, I don't know. But this statute, there is a recent news article in which some commentators were talking about pending amendments to the statute. And by the way, there is an amendment sitting on the governor's desk right now that may cure some of these issues. I don't think that Mr. Hall is going to be able to benefit from that, because his lawsuit was filed way before the statute passed. But the quote from another appellate lawyer, not me, someone that I do know, is that this statute is a procedural freak show. And I couldn't help but raise that in the argument today, because it's so descriptive of what the statute is. At least when it comes to allowing an attorney, as Mr. Dyke is asking this court to do, to admit, I'm a lawyer. Yes, I owe you a fiduciary duty. I'm your lawyer because I perform legal services for you. He didn't say, I admit I'm your lawyer, but he certainly admitted the underlying facts, which is he did all the legal work. So isn't this the very definition of absurd, to say that you can go and admit these things? What if it's a deposition? Let's say it's a deposition and a witness admits all the facts relevant in the case. Can the other side not attach that deposition transcript and say, you've just admitted your case, summary judgment? Or is that going to draw a TCPA motion? That's pretty much the situation we're dealing with here.
Can I ask a different question, kind of change gears a little bit? How will the controversy be resolved by the declarations that you're seeking, at least those that are based on the DRs?
You're going back to Craig, and you're going back to Hawkshurst, and I very much appreciate that, Justice Goodwin, and I can certainly answer that question. There is 100% overlay between the I count five declarations that are being asked for. These are listed in our brief at pages 16 to 17. the new claims that are the only target of this TCPA motion. So the declarations that we're asking for are, this is an agreement between an attorney and client. And it's a contingent fee agreement between the attorney and client. It doesn't meet the requirements of a contingent fee agreement. It's a prohibited transaction. And we also asked for a declaration that Mr. Dyke should be disgorged of any fee. Those are all components of the breach of fiduciary duty claim. With the attorney-client relationship comes a fiduciary duty. With an attorney-client relationship comes the right to terminate the agreement at any time. Yet this agreement, the management agreement, provides, it's for a 15-year term and requires assent from Mr. Dyke to terminate it. In fact, it's clear in the record, Mr. Hall tried to terminate it. And Mr. Dyke said no and said, and not only that, but you owe me every penny that ever comes out of this deal for anything I ever touched, which I think is on its face unconscionable. So I have an issue with Mr. Dyke's counsel's interpretation of Hawkshurst. Hawkshurst really had to do with sanctions. It talks very little about attorney's fees, and that was one basis that was cited in a brief for why this is legal relief and not this sui generis type of relief, which Craig makes very clear. I can't speak to why Justice Pemberton wrote the tome that he wrote in Craig. It's very interesting reading, and I've read it I don't know how many times, and I still struggle to figure out exactly what he's saying, other than I think the net result is Declaratory Judgment Act claims are neither legal nor equitable. And we've all read and sort of, I dare I say, been beaten over the head a bit with opinions that say you've got to interpret the statute literally. Right. And so if what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If a Declaratory Judgment Act case is neither legal nor equitable, the only thing the statute applies to is legal and equitable claims. Whether there's fees generated, authorized by the statute or not, there's no authority for the idea that turns it into a legal claim. It's a avenue of relief.
Okay.
And in fact, there's other authority that says that fees aren't damages, and so it's really not a legal claim. So I see that I am about out of time. Unless the court has additional questions, I'll take my seat. Thank you.
Your Honors, I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. I just have a few brief points in response. One of the issues that Mr. Smith raised here was the question of, well, can a summary judgment filing in and of itself be evidence that the TCPA looks at? The problem with that argument is that means that any TCPA response is now evidence. Because that would be, in terms of a pleading or response to a motion to dismiss, that you could now rely on that, which means that anyone could simply state whatever they want in the response and that would now or should be now considered to be evidence. That would be, when we talk about the absurdity doctrine, that would be absurd. That would eviscerate the statute.
Well, then what does it mean, the pleadings? What do pleadings mean then?
Your Honor, it means the documents that contain the legal action, whatever the legal action is that they're talking about, that you can use that. And that's what the Serafine case said. That's what other cases have said, is that you look to those pleadings that have the legal action, because that's going to frame and decide what it is. And you can use those as being some of the prima facie case evidence that's there. But it can't be conclusory statements either. And here what they did was is they simply cited to what was the summary judgment pleading. They don't cite to any exhibits in the summary judgment in their TCPA response. There is one line where they say we incorporate all those in the exhibits, but that's exactly what the Cavan v. Abbott case, what happened there, is they simply said, hey, you've got to find something in all these documents. It's clear, you know, because look at this huge, almost 200-page petition with exhibits, it's got to be in there somewhere, without actually specifically linking any of the elements to any of those pieces of evidence. And they never did so in the district court below. In terms of the judicial admissions doctrine, we are in no way saying that you can't use any sort of statements that other people have made in judicial filings or otherwise, and the TCPA doesn't say you can't use those either. There's no conflict between those. Of course you can use those things. There may be something where the TCPA would apply to whatever statements you made related to using those filings, if you're relying on those as the basis for your claims. But all it does is it doesn't say that the claims get dismissed or you can't use it or anything like that. It just means you have to provide the clear and specific evidence. It just shifts the burden. And that's what happened here. But they didn't meet their burden for clear and specific evidence. And there's nothing in any sort of doctrine of judicial admissions that would render that absurd in any way, shape, or form.
Well, why wouldn't the presumption of unfairness that Mr. Smith was talking about be enough to meet the burden?
Because, Your Honor, it goes back to you are eviscerating the motion to dismiss standard. And even in that, when you're asking for fee forfeiture, as the Gammon case said, you still have to show enough for the court to determine, the trial court, to determine whether or not there was a breach, a clear and specific breach, that would enable fee forfeiture and the amount of fee forfeiture. And so in order to be successful on the claim, which is what's required under the TCPA, you still have to show all those elements. I'm not disputing that it's possible that a presumption of unfairness might apply, but it doesn't eviscerate the burden for a motion to dismiss to show clear and specific evidence as to each of the elements. It just simply provides that presumption, or could provide that presumption of unfairness, but you still need to show that fee forfeiture would be warranted here, and specifically the amount of fee forfeiture.
Counsel.
Yes, sir.
Are you familiar with the case First United Pentecostal Church of Beaumont?
I might have seen it, Your Honor, and it doesn't come to mind right now, so I apologize.
It's okay. It's a recent Texas Supreme Court case, 514 Southwest 3rd, 214, 2017 case. I was just going to ask you how that might affect your case.
And Your Honor, I'm sure I've at least seen the initial notes on that. I have not dug into that in depth, but I'm happy to provide any sort of supplemental briefing if the court would be interested in that.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Your Honor.
If you do, then I'm sure Mr. Smith will want to respond.
Absolutely,
and
Your Honor.
And so we'll just say that you'll both have permission to do so. That way you can skip that little filing fee once we ask for it up here.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
And I think specifically, correct me if I'm wrong, Justice Baker, we'd want to know about, I think in that case versus Parker, the Supreme Court held that a plaintiff is not required to show causation and actual damages as to equitable remedies. And so, therefore, under your argument, we'd like for you to address how that would apply, if at all. So,
yes, Your Honor.
Just to give you a little direction of
thank you, Your Honor.
Where we're going.
And
it's a good thing this is recorded, right?
Yes, <Your Honor.
laughs> Otherwise, you would have been, like, scribbling notes furiously trying to get all that.
Still was, Your Honor.
Sure. We took up some of your time. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm out of time, Your Honor. So if there's any more questions, I'm happy to answer. Otherwise, we would ask that the new claims be dismissed and the case be remanded for further proceedings.
I have one question.
Yep.
And nobody's addressed it, which is I believe that it comes to y'all's defense and whether you have stated a defense, an affirmative defense or not. Do you believe that you have stated an affirmative defense? Do you believe that failure to state a claim for which relief can be granted is an affirmative defense?
Yes, Your Honor. We do think we've stated that claim. That is the defense that we would use in terms of they are seeking relief they can't get in terms of trying to enforce the disciplinary rules, which would be stating a claim for relief that they can't get. So we would say yes, that we have appropriately raised that affirmative defense. And I know that being in trial court, I did that on purpose as that was the defense that we were falling under. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Well done, and the case will be submitted. With that, we are in recess.